What's up, guys? This is Daniel Fenari here from Polaris. You are here on the 9-8 podcast, the podcast whose theme music is in 4-4.
Has finally come. I've been outright saying that I'd finally nail this bloke down to get him on the show, and all it took was a worldwide pandemic, a lockdown, him dislocating his shoulder in a freak accident, and of course the correct alignment of stars and moon along the 23rd degree to get him into my studio despite the 5-minute walk from his place to mine. He's one of the founding members of Sydney-based metalcore outfit Polaris, and just an all-round awesome dude and drummer. Finally, I get to say this, welcome to the show, Dan Fenari.
Thank you, man. Yeah, I was just saying that today. It's like we've been talking about this for probably like at least a year, maybe more.
Long time.
Could be two. It's probably, it's crazy. And thinking it's funny just to think about as well, like how our paths keep crossing, like how we met at a Bring Me the Horizon listening party, was it?
Oh.
A Sony, that's when we met, right?
No.
Did we meet backstage somewhere at a show or like
You and I met through Tess.
No, before that.
Really?
I met you before that.
Okay.
I thought we talked about... Have we never talked about this?
I don't think we've ever talked about this.
Yeah, no. Okay, wow. All right. Wow, this is a great opportunity to tell this story, man. I swear you knew about this. So we met when I was working for Blunt and you were working for... Would it have been The Music?
Or AU, I'm guessing.
AU? AU Review. Why they make it so hard to say? The AU Review. You were working for AU Review and I rocked up to... I was working for Blunt. We were covering the... That's the Spirit. That's the record, right? That's the Spirit. Bring Me the Horizon. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
We were covering
okay.
That's the Spirit.
Yeah.
The record had just come out it hadn't come out. It was a very secret listening party. I remember we were all embargoed that we couldn't talk about it. We were literally not even allowed. I remember I was about to post a Facebook status because I was young and stupid that night bragging about how I'd just heard the new Bring Me the Horizon album. There was no screaming on it. And I went, I literally am legally embargoed not to say that because they hadn't even announced that there was a record. So even though everybody knew that there was, it was this big secret thing. And we rocked up to Sony and it's funny because I just thought that you remembered this, but I guess I thought we'd talked about it, but
no.
So, and I met you and then there was our friend Emily, who you probably still know, who used to work for Blunt.
Yes.
I don't know if, a couple of our other friends, mutual friends from back then would have been there as well. And we listened to the That's the Spirit album and it wasn't even mixed yet. And I remember standing in the street outside Sony HQ in Sydney and you were wearing like a vest and a tie and like a burgundy shirt. And I was like, man, this guy's dressed sharp as hell for this. Cause I rocked up and I was in like, dude, I used to go to when I was working at that magazine, I used to go in wearing like track pants and stuff. I didn't care. So like we was, you know, it's a music mag, you know, we were very casual.
For
so
sure.
I remember rocking up to that. I mean, I did put jeans on for the Sony party, but I rocked up and I was like, oh God, I'm going to look like such a fool. This guy's like dressed so snappy with his vest and his burgundy tie. And and we met briefly and it wasn't until a few years later that I put two and two together and remembered that that was how we'd met. Probably after I met you again through Tess and I was like, wow. And I'd put the connection, but I just forgot.
I'd forgotten that.
We probably did establish this when we re-met, but maybe it's just been so long that we've forgotten that. But yeah, but we did that Sony, that listening party, and that's how I remember you.
I think this is obviously, you know, the age now that I'm
you
at.
Start forgetting things.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, oh shit, that actually happened. Fuck. Okay.
Conveniently, it's all come full circle now because when I met you, you had a beard and a ponytail, and then by the time I re-met you, you looked completely different, and now you're back to beard and ponytail, Dave. So it's good.
Just without the vest and the
shirt. I can confirm that I'm definitely talking to the same person, and this isn't a figment of my imagination. Because that's good.
See, I always thought we met through Tess, but
as Oatley residents.
Remotely, as I like to call it.
Well, I like that, the small town that it is.
Exactly. So awesome to have you on the show.
Because no, it's fun. It's nice.
Such a big long thing.
And as you said, there's been no excuse except for the fact that I've been out of the country a lot. But given that we live a little two streets away from each other, there's no, it's like, it's actually, we've just been talking about it and the times have just never synced up. But it's nice to... as you said, sometimes things are a bit serendipitous, and a worldwide pandemic gives you a good excuse to finally, yeah, sit down and have a cup of tea and talk about music.
Exactly. So, and that's actually literally what's happening right now, by the way. There are Tim Tams and there's a cup of tea.
I brought Tim Tams.
And you did it. You did the right thing. I love Tim Tams. So we'll get on to actually some of the pandemic and your touring sure. schedule a little bit later.
Yeah.
But first thing, I talk a lot on this show about the way the Sydney music scene used to be. Now, I want you to take us back.
We're going to get nostalgic here.
Now, Polaris started when yourself and Jake met at school.
That's correct, yes.
Met as part of a Battle of the Bands or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And you sort of started working together. You filled out the rest of the band.
Yeah.
Started working up through the ranks. But I want you to take us back to the early days of the scene in Sydney. Now, I can remember seeing you guys play on the floor of halls out in like Western Sydney and such, you know, people doing the crazy windmill, don't stand within 10 minutes. That'd actually be really, really good for social distancing, actually, now.
Yeah,
just getting those kids in the pit. And
I think I saw someone bring that same point up, actually. Like, technically, you know, a lot of moshing is quite socially distanced. You know, you're creating a bit of a bubble around yourself if you move your arms correctly. So, violent bubble. That's the name of my next album.
It's progressive nouveau jazz outfit, violent bubble. But I can remember seeing you guys out there, but I'd love you to paint a picture for our listeners about what it was like back then, what the scene was like, and obviously how it compares to the scene now, how it compares to what you're seeing now as well.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. First, I've probably got to set the scene of what it was like before we actually started. So when I first started going to gigs, my entry to local gigs was like, obviously, I mean, I guess around the age of 12, I'd kind of gotten into really heavily into pop punk and, a little bit of that kind of stuff, as well as kind of like classic rock. And then, when I got into high school, I was just really kind of just discovering other kind of varieties of punk rock and metal and stuff like that, and being introduced to that world. And I was seeking out, I'd played a couple of shows with my friends at like a little youth, like a, you know, a church hall where that was, you know, it was like a band night for local kids. You know what I mean? Like for under 18s.
Was and this we got the one up, at Padstow?
No, this was Sutherland. It was across the road from my primary school then. And me and my best friends at the time, we made our first little band. We were about 12. And so our introduction was playing these little kind of youth nights that were put on for kids to, you know, if you had a band, get up and play. If you don't have a band, start a band for the purposes of this and have a good time. Yeah. And it was very nice and very, you know, and it was all parents and friends coming to watch. But we got up there and we covered Blink and Green Day and stuff, and it was terrible. And then we did it again the next year and it was better.
Yeah.
We were actually playing in time by that point, which was really a really big step for us. I was seeking out shows. I wanted to get that same experience, not only to play it, but then obviously, you know, I was spent all my free time just like watching videos of shows online, and all I wanted was to go and I want to go see the mosh pits, you know, see all that crazy stuff happen. And like, then I remember one of my other best friends at the time, was a dude named Harry, he's a great guy, and his older brother played in this band called the Midday Fiasco. They were a punk band from the Shire. Funnily enough, their drummer now makes Evett's Drums, which is like one of Australia's best drum brands. He's a terrific guy, Steve Crawley. But they were this local band, and I was like, my friend's brother plays in a punk rock band. This is great. This is so sick. So I would go out to see them playing shows at like the Genali Battle of the Bands and stuff, which was at a little youth hall. And you know, there would be like sometimes like 150 kids there. Like, it was crazy. A lot of people were coming out and they would mosh. Like, and I'm seeing like teenagers, kids my age, like moshing for local bands. And to me, that was like a big deal. I was like, oh, you don't just play and they stand around and your mum claps. Like, kids are actually like, these bands have fans, and the fans, they want to move, and there's an energy in the room. And I was like addicted. I was like, oh my God. So then anytime a little hardcore show came through the Janelli Hall or something, I would go out to that. So that was kind of my introduction. Yeah.
Oh, Janelli Hall.
RIP, man. It's a tiny little place with that little portrait of the Queen above the stage. Yeah. Do you remember the one? Yeah. Dude, so iconic. I think there was a similar one in the Blacktown Hall, I think, had a little, that weird little picture of the Queen. I don't know what it is with community halls. They love the Queen.
Who doesn't?
Thanks, Liz. on you, Liz. They like, that was how I kind of got addicted to the thing of going to local shows. And then me and my friends were kind of through high schools trying to also start up a band so we could do that thing. And honestly, like, if you ask any of my friends at the time, they'll tell you like that my number one concern in life as to how we would get our band started was we just have to get our band like to the stage that we can enter that local Battle of the Bands competition in Ginelli. That was literally like, that was my measure of how we would break into the scene. And Jake and I, we still laugh about it sometimes. Cause when I met Jake, we were doing our school's Battle of the Bands and, I was kind of the first person that he'd met that could play anything metal on the drums. So it was like, great, we'll make a band. So, and I was telling, I was like, yeah, we just got to enter this Ginelli Battle of the Bands thing. He was like, yeah, whatever, dude. But so, over time, you know, we did discover that there was more to life than that little local community hall. And we started, once we started trying to get our band together and we were looking at what's going on then, I guess that scene kind of died down when I was like 15 or so. And then I was really fortunate that then by the time I was about 18 or 19, it was just picking up again. So there was maybe like a 3-year kind of lull in Sutherland Shire hardcore shows, which doesn't seem like much, but when you're a teenager and you suddenly shows disappear for a few years, it's a bit of a bummer. And then they came back, which was we were really lucky. They just kind of started coming back right around the time that we finally got a band together. So they'd started putting on shows at St. John's Hall in Sutherland, which was a tiny little church hall. And they're like, Ginelli was long gone, but there was, a club that used to be known as Hunters in Sutherland, which was known as Hunters, if you don't know, was known as the where you go at the end of the night when you're one of the dregs, when you're one of the leftovers, you go to Hunters. Yeah. And that's where you take your last bets. You know, maybe you try to find a friendly single person to go home with for the night, or that's the stereotype, was that it was this kind of dingy bar, and they decided to put on shows, and they asked a guy from one of the local who worked at one of the local rehearsal and recording studios help put on shows. And so they, for a short time, we built this little scene in Sutherland. So I actually met Rick, who's one of our guitarists, through a local show in the Shire as well. One of those shows at St. John's Hall when Buried in Verona were playing.
Yeah.
If you remember them. And I mean, so the bands
I remember them.
I guess also to contextualize. So the bands that were coming up around that time that I remember, obviously there was bands like Buried in Verona who were kind of at the time, one of the most, successful heavy bands to come out of the Shire, one of the only ones to be successful and be signed at that time. And then there was, there's bands like The Ocean, The Sky, who we became good friends with over the years, as we did with Biv as well. But, we worshiped that Ocean, The Sky EP, man. I loved that band when we were in high school. And, bands like Aslock. Fucking loved Aslock. And like, it was just sick. There was another one called like Another Day's Remains. I remember a band coming through from like maybe another state that was called like The War. I definitely wouldn't lie and say I was like heaps in the know about like the true hardcore scene that we had, but I was more into just like these crossover metalcore and pop punk bands and stuff. There were heaps of bands coming up, man. Like that Ginelli scene was really great. And there were all these kids in local high schools at the time. I feel like there was a really beautiful boom in like the early 2000s. I'm so thankful that we got to be part of the generation where when I was 13 years old, a lot of kids were picking up instruments. I wasn't the only one, you know, me and my friends, there was the right music on the radio for it. Right. You know, Green Day had just broken with American Idiot. And I mean, when I say broken, I mean, you know, as a worldwide phenomenon that kids could pick up on. I'm not talking Dookie. You know, I'm talking when they became mainstream. So I'm talking punk rock had just become visibly mainstream in for better or worse, no matter what you think of that, it had.
Yeah.
And for us at that age, you know, that meant so many kids had discovered a type of music that they could learn. I mean, we were playing punk rock songs in a matter of weeks when we picked up our instruments. It wasn't hard. So like, that's the beauty of it. So we were really lucky. I think there was this really wonderful combination of forces when I was like between the ages of say like 10 to 16 that came together that, you know, Guitar Hero had just dropped as a game. You know how many kids like wouldn't be playing music if it wasn't for Guitar Hero? Yeah. Like all of these things got all these high schoolers and stuff playing music. And I guess then there was a wave that died off, but then I was fortunate that I guess, being of the age that I was, that when I just got out of high school, I was lucky enough to be in that wave when now we'd stopped messing around and playing covers. And now we were all at the age where we wanted to play in real bands.
Yeah.
So luckily there popped up from that wave of, I guess, kids who, started playing Guitar Hero and discovered those records when I did, probably also at a similar time where then forming metalcore bands in our local scene. And that was the style that was popping off. Cause let's be honest, like in Australia, heavy music, metalcore is the predominant thing.
Absolutely.
Because Parkway and Prom Queen and Amity made it what it was. That's like,
we do it
that
well.
That was the scene. Yeah, we do. And there's a great lineage. Like there's a great line of where you realize you can go. And there's a really wonderful scene of support for that type of music. So I think, It was just, yeah, this great melting pot. And so we came up, the Sutherland Shire started getting a bit more active. We were playing down at that Hunters Club, or they changed it to, they called it Studio Six after a while. For, we probably played there like once every month and a half for like about a year. It was just us and the Ocean, the Sky, and these bands like Spheres and Alaska and Castles. Mm-hmm. We were all friends, and it was really great, honestly. Like, we fostered a really cool thing in our local scene, just because we made friends with these dudes who are similar age to us and just wanted to play shows and drink a few beers afterwards and have fun.
Yeah.
And so we would do that. And I mean, our first few shows, aside from the Sutherland ones and stuff like that, were technically, we started out, Western Sydney was a lot busier for shows. So they had St. Mary's.
Yes.
Have you ever heard of the Lucky Oz Tavern?
Yeah.
Have you ever been to the Lucky Oz Tavern?
Yes.
You're not too lucky if you go to the Lucky Oz Tavern. No offense, I'm sorry. And I'm grateful to that venue. They put on everybody.
Yeah.
And it was literally like anyone could book a show there. Like you could be a local promoter. Like you could be, I don't even know if you had to be 18 to play there. I can't remember, but like, there was this little beer garden out the back with this kind of this stage that had this enormous, I think it was a Jim Beam or Jack Daniels banner on it that was very recognizable. You'll see it in all the photos from that time. There's bands playing, kids in like wife beater singlets with like I Killed the Prom Queen lyrics on them, playing in front of the big Jim Beam sign. And it's like, it takes me to that place. Like, I love that. Like, and those shows were hilarious, man. You know, like 30 or 40 people there, mostly just other bands. We sounded like crap. Everybody sounded like crap.
Yep.
But it was fun. Like, we cut our teeth on that stuff. And I think it taught us to treat every show as like an opportunity.
Yeah.
I think our approach when we first started this band is, and this is what I would honestly recommend to anyone like doing this in the early stages, is for your first year or so, literally throw yourself on any show and then start making smart decisions about things like once anyone cares about you, then start making decisions about when do you, you know, spacing your shows out so that people actually come.
Yeah.
Because when in the first early days, you honestly just can't even expect people to come just for you. 100%. That's my view. That's how we viewed it, is we just went, you know, we only have a few friends that like this music. They're not going to come every time we play anyway, no matter how often or how infrequent it is. Let's just really get good at this. So we played as many shows as we could in every single corner of Sydney and like the greater Sydney region and Wollongong and stuff. Until we got a little bit better at what we were doing. And then I think that meant that then by the time people started taking notice of what we were doing, it was then an appropriate time to slow down and space out the shows and actually try and get people to come who cared.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that's a progression that we made. But I, what makes me sad, I guess now, is that I look at a lot of bands coming up at the moment. I have friends bands who are in this situation where they just don't have enough shows to play. We had a litany. We had like a dirge of shows to play, man. Like there was just no short. There were shows being booked all the time, and we just didn't knock anything back. So I think in our first, you know, all the shows we played were on weekends, but I think in our first year, we probably played like 30 shows in Sydney alone. I'm talking, that's out of 52 weekends in a year. That's a lot of shows to play in Sydney. You're not supposed to do that, but it didn't matter because we were just getting good at it and we didn't really care. So the problem is now I feel like there aren't enough shows going on for bands to actually get that experience live. And so then bands, they're like, we've been a band for like 2 years and we want to get on tours. I've seen friends' bands be in this position where they've been a band for a couple of years and they're struggling to get on tours. But the problem is that their live chops maybe aren't, they haven't had enough time to catch up their live chops because the shows aren't frequent enough at home. So it's this vicious cycle where like, how are you supposed to get on tours if you haven't played enough shows to get tighter? But how are you supposed to play enough shows to get tighter if you won't go on tour?
Yeah.
So like, yeah. I think it's, I really worry actually at the moment that there aren't enough people putting on shows due to the venue restrictions, and not just COVID, I mean, but Sydney in general.
Yeah. New South Wales.
You know, we've-
Grandma Gladys.
Yeah, we don't exactly have it easy here in a lot of ways for people to put on their own shows right now. Or I think people are kind of scared of it. So I hope that in the next few years it does come back, because like I said, we were lucky to come up with when we did. And I don't know if we'd be in the position that we're in now if we had started our band a few years later. Yeah. The scene was very different. Like we copped a really lucky wave, and we were lucky that we were able to kind of go up and down with that in terms of the type of shows we played. But don't get me wrong though, there's still tons of great shows and good promoters in Sydney. There just should be more.
Yeah, Absolutely. I mean, it's funny, I was talking to the unofficial third host of the podcast, Joshua Batten, who's a guy from Melbourne. And after the whole thing that happened with ProGaid and so on and so forth, which I think I've filled you in on, he said to me, man, I will never complain about Melbourne music scene ever again. This is half the battle, man.
Look, it's true, man. Melbourne sells out, even just generally, Melbourne sells out my band's shows before any other city does.
Yeah.
Almost every time. It's and that's not, weirdly enough, we sell more tickets in Sydney, but Melbourne is very responsive and they're very instantly supportive. They don't hesitate and it's really beautiful. I think we come to think of it, we might have even had our first sellout show in Melbourne anywhere. Like, I don't know. I don't know what it is. People love to put shit on Melbourne for, oh, you know, they think they're superior. They have this hipster culture compared to Sydney. Sydney's got a whole other set of chips on its shoulders that we don't even need to get into. But like the fact of the matter is, man, at least they like show great, at least their government shows appreciation for the arts.
Mm.
Like to my understanding, like Jesus Christ, our government just couldn't give two shits about it in this state. So it's like, it really does feel like a bit of a screw you sometimes, which is a bummer because it feels like our, you know, Sydney has produced tons of really wonderful music for decades.
Well, it's a $65 billion industry too.
Yeah.
So the arts as a whole, I mean, not just the music industry, but the arts as a whole. And when you look at that in comparison to, say, sport, sport's an $80 billion industry. So it's not that, okay, yes, it's $15 billion. Okay,
you've done a lot more of the numbers than I have. You're good at this.
It's
not that big of a difference. You're right.
It's not that big of a difference. So, you know, then the question becomes, well, why have we got a roadmap for getting people to go back and watch people, you know, punt balls through a giant H and we don't have a roadmap for the bars and the pubs and all that sort of stuff?
What I don't understand is I love how we've just inevitably, we're like one, two questions in the podcast and we've ended up on this already. But it is pretty atrocious to just be like, don't get me wrong, I think sports are fantastic. I'm not a sporting enthusiast of most sports myself, but I think it's great. And I think I love the community aspect of blah, 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 blah. But it's like the fact is though, the idea of it being such a priority over other things like this, the clutching of the pearls is what bothers me. The when can we get our sports people back on the field? And not that I think everyone, you know, I feel for anyone who can't work right now, but there's a lot of us who can't work. And not only are we not getting this pearl clutching drawn and this attention drawn to us, except by those who are actually fighting for it, not by those who are in charge. Like, yeah, we're also not afforded the, you know, the same support financially that those industries are. And as, you know, we kind of just got onto this topic just before we started recording, but the crazy thing is that most sports players there are systems in place to ensure that professional sports people get paid.
Yes.
When things like this happens, if a game gets canceled for weather or any of this stuff happens, the people get paid. Do you know who that never works for? Almost never, as far as I know, is musicians. It's 100%. Like circumstances, if the concert doesn't go ahead, then the tickets have to be refunded to the people. And if the tickets have to be refunded to the people, then the artist doesn't get to keep it. Like that's the funny thing. You know, we just canceled a tour, right, in Europe that was already, I mean, we canceled multiple tours, but only one of them was announced. That's the crazy thing is people were messaging us and going, oh, if I don't take the refund, will you guys get to keep the money? Which is so sweet of them. Like, it's so wonderful that people think like that. And they're like, what can I do for you guys to keep the money? And I'm like, unfortunately, it doesn't matter because even if you don't get the refund, we don't get that money from the ticket company. The refund goes to the ticket money and we get nothing. And I'm not saying that that's like, I mean, that's just kind of how it has to work. I guess there could be insurance systems in place, then maybe there should be. But at the end of the day, it's just like, I don't think anybody quite realizes that when a musician cancels a concert, everybody suffers.
That's right.
No one walks away winning. And I can't believe the bullshit that you see from that before COVID got really serious, you know, before people realized and everyone was getting criticized for canceling their tours. Oh, you guys should just come here. Like, why? It's the same thing that happened to us when we missed a flight for a show.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh yeah, you probably just didn't care about playing the show. It's like, do you realize that like we get nothing out of not playing a show? It means we walk away with no money, sell barely any merch and make no new fans. Who wins out of this?
Yeah, exactly.
And you're all upset.
See, that was really funny because
it's very funny.
That was the one in Luna Park, right? That was the Luna Park.
Architect show. Oh man, that sucked, man. That was like one of the worst days on tour ever.
Well, what happened with that? Because I heard out of this, and we've discussed this before actually, but what I heard was that it wasn't you guys, it was your gear. You couldn't get your gear down and all that sort of stuff.
I just don't know where this information comes from. That's the funniest thing, is people are, someone's like, I heard it was the gear. Who'd you hear that from? No one said that. It's all like, there's all these you know, these rumors abound in the audience. Be like, I heard Polaris isn't coming tonight. I heard they don't even want to play. I heard they hate metalcore.
I heard they hate our fans.
Yeah, I heard they hate all of their fans. Yeah, I've heard that they've got really rich off this tour, and they've all bought Lamborghinis, and they just don't care about us anymore. I feel like I'm starting to go into like a South Park voice just then, but it was like, no, it was really funny. Like I don't think people really understand how much of a bummer it is to lose a show like that when you're on a tour, you know, and also like all realize like. Oh, I mean, I don't want to get into this too much, but it is a funny story to talk about. Because so what is like, we rocked up to the airport and there'd been those freak winds. There was like 24 hours or 48 hours of freak winds in Sydney.
Yeah.
It was Sydney, wasn't it? Brisbane, I think, was fine. But we were coming from Brisbane and we got told the night before, your flight's been delayed by 2 hours. Mm. We're like, great. And that was the thing, is that other people were like, well, why didn't you, if you knew that your flight was going to be delayed, you could have driven overnight. And we were like, we got told the flight was going to be at 11 o'clock. Not that it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
So when someone tells you your flight's delayed by 2 hours, that happens on tours all the time. If we got in a van and started driving interstate every time our flight got delayed by an hour, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I know.
Like,
you may as well just go around Australia in a van.
So we were like, and that was the worst part was, is that people were like, you could have made it here. And I was like, you know what the sad part is though, is you don't realize that we didn't get told we weren't actually ever getting on a flight until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
That's right.
And if we had found out at 7 o'clock in the morning, you bet your ass we would have got in that van and we would have driven all the way here. Like, we would have done it. We were prepping for it, but we were like, no, they've said there's a flight.
Yeah.
So we, unfortunately, like, we just didn't, no one was getting on flights. And the other two bands made it on just because they happened to be in front of us in the queue for the flight, one of the flights that did go early.
Yeah.
And then not only did we not get the next flight after that, we didn't get any. So then we arrive in Sydney and it was such a bummer. Like, and we have the other thing is though, what people don't realize, and this isn't intending to throw anyone under the bus, but there are contracts in place that if you're a band and you actually have to pull out of a show for travel reasons or anything, you're actually not allowed to just announce it as soon as you know. I don't know if fans are aware of this, but if you have to pull out of a show and you're on the billing and you've been used to sell tickets, your name sold tickets, then you're actually not allowed to go and just say, hey guys, we're pulling out, without talking to the management company. Yeah. You have to, there are contracts in place and there are like, so we actually weren't, and this is, and I understand this, but we weren't able to tell people until a certain time of day. And by that time they were already in the venue, and that's not our, we didn't wait to tell them. We were literally told, all right, you can announce it at this time.
Yeah.
And I understand the reasons why they limit that. That's, I don't even have an issue with that. But the bummer is that fans don't get that. And they're like, you waited until we were already inside to tell us. And I'm super sad for those people, man. Like, cause I know how much of a, and I guarantee that I'm every bit as sad as they were about missing that show. Cause you bet I wanted to play in front of 3,500 people.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, one of my favorite, when I say favorite, I mean like made me the most angry, but I just kind of had to laugh. There was a comment on that where some guy said something like, yeah, before you guys, yeah, I'll bet before you guys had played Wembley Arena, you guys would have made more effort to get to this show. Probably don't care anymore. And I was like, is that how you think it works? Like, do you think that because 9 months ago I played a nice venue in London that I no longer care about playing in front of 3,000 people in my hometown?
Yeah.
Is that what you think?
Yeah.
Because it's just, and I was talking to the architects guys about it afterwards, and they were just laughing. They're like, don't get worked up about it, man. They're like, stop reading the comments.
They
said,
comments off.
They were saying, they're like, we've had the same shit. Like, where you're just like, are you actually kidding me? Right. Did you think about that?
Yeah.
About how little sense that makes, but it's a bummer. People really love to assume the worst in people sometimes. And they just don't understand how much these things can be out of your control.
Well, I remember that weekend too, because that was the weekend I was up in, I went to Brisbane for the Dead of Winter Festival.
Dead of Winter, yes.
It was the same weekend.
That was a fun festival.
It was awesome.
Oh wait, sorry, the year that you mean, oh yeah, we didn't play that year.
No, it was the same year that you had those issues. This was last year.
Those architect shows. Yeah.
It was last year.
Yeah, okay. Because we played Dead of Winter the year before, yeah.
We myself and a friend of mine, we went up.
Did you get stuck in Brizzy or?
No. So we went up the day before, right?
Yeah.
But I know so many bands up there who went up, who they had to swap the whole day around because people couldn't get out of Sydney, et cetera, et cetera. There was one band there, which I'm pretty sure was Sumeru, I think, from memory, the bass player, Pat. they actually couldn't get to the venue. There was no flights. Yeah. So they got an Uber from Sydney to Newcastle.
Oh my Jesus.
Right.
Got in a $500 Uber.
Got in a flight from there to the Gold Coast and then an Uber from the Gold Coast to Forty Valley.
Oh my God. From Gold Coast, not even Brisbane?
No, Gold Coast.
Oh my God.
To play a 35-minute set.
That sucks.
That's what they did.
So no, but I respect the hustle. You know what I love? I love a crazy tour story. I love here's what we did to get to the gig story. I will actually applaud that. I've heard some great ones.
But I think the notion that people don't care about their fans and all that sort of stuff. You hear stories like that, and then you hear stories from sort of peeling back the curtain a little bit where you say things like, we couldn't say anything, we didn't know, et cetera, et cetera.
There are legal things going on behind 100%. The scenes. And that's us. We're not even a big band. When people get mad at someone like some huge hip-hop star or something because they cancel someone, like, I know it's upsetting, but it's like, do you not realize how many contracts are around this guy and how many people are probably in his ear saying, you don't dare talk about this. You don't dare throw these people under the bus. So that artist takes the fall.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, the sad part is a lot of the time, I mean, not directly, they don't say I'm at fault, but they say this is canceled and they're the ones that cop the flack. It's 100%. Not the management. It's not the venue. It's not the promotions company. Mm. The artist cops it first. And so much of the time, like at least in my experience of people I've talked to who have had similar things, they would have given anything to get on that stage. Like, dude, if you had any idea what we were working out to make that Architects show go ahead, we spent that entire afternoon sitting in the airport calling Architects crew. I was briefing their drum tech, who legend Freddie was like down to help me out with this. He was like, yep, I'll pop your kit out. Tell me where everything I was going to like describe to him on the phone as best as I could, how to get my drums all out of the cases and set them up as close as possible to how I like them so that I could run in, and he was going to tune them for me so that I could run in, shove the thing on stage, mic it up and go.
Yeah.
Like we were putting systems in place, or I think we even contacted While She Sleeps to say, do we just do one kit tonight? Can I jump on your kit?
Yep.
Like we were working out every avenue. We were literally ready to run in the door and run on stage in 5 minutes. Like
run
we
in had the door, plug in and play.
And people have no idea. And that's the sad part, is that we were ready to do absolutely anything. And as it happened, we literally didn't arrive to the event, no matter how much we tried and thought, we genuinely thought we were going to get there until we got off the plane. When we landed, I was like, we could actually make the set. And everyone's like, Dan, it's not happening.
Yeah.
I was like, our TM was like, buddy, come on. Our gear's still in the plane. It hasn't come out yet. I'm like, but the show. But like, yeah, it was rough, man. Do you know how dejected it is? I don't want to sound like I'm whinging or this is a feel sorry for me moment. It isn't in any way. I'm just kind of trying to relate on a human level here. Like, please imagine how it feels. Like, there's a real high school feeling to walking. It's like walking in late to assembly when they've just read out your name for detention, and then you walk in and everyone looks at you.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like walking in to the Big Top at Luna Park with a backpack and a suitcase, head down, dejected as shit, marching our way through the crowd to the green room at 9:15, 5 minutes after our set would have ended. That shit sucks. Like, believe me, it sucks. Like, you're walking through and everyone, and you can hear people saying like, dude, isn't that the, oh shit, they're here. Oh my God, they're actually here, man. And half of them, I think, going, oh wow, it's genuine. They really did just arrive here. And the other half are going, oh, well, if you're here, why couldn't you just play the show?
Yeah.
Why didn't Architects move their set later so you guys could play? I was laughing about that afterwards. Like, imagine expecting the headline band of an arena-sized show to move their set time.
But even more than that, imagine curfew being moved. In Sydney.
Like, it's not insane. It's like, lights out at 11 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly. Be tucked in bed.
The Australian government's checking to make sure you don't have a torch under the blankets reading a book. You know, we wouldn't want that. Like, never want that.
It's an interesting scene, though, the metalcore scene, because it is...
I love it.
Reasonably...
It's my home.
It's reasonably supportive, right?
It has its issues, but it is... I do love it. I'll back it.
I mean, you get dicks in every scene, right? And you get him in the country scene, you get him in metalcore scene, you get him in the hip-hop scene. But you have mentioned elsewhere in other interviews that you aren't just a metalcore band.
As in Polaris?
Polaris. In actual fact, you don't like labels. Do you feel that labels are inherently dangerous, is my question,
no.
to a band?
I'm actually not.
As in, it can pigeonhole you.
Record labels? Absolutely. No, I'm kidding. Hey, Zinger. No, I'm kidding. I fucking love my record label. Actually, I love the hell out of my record label. But what you're saying is that, yeah, I actually really like this conversation about the labeling and the genre thing, because the way we've looked at it is like, I don't want anyone to think that I never ever want to come across as one of those types of artists that's like, we're not a metalcore band, you know, that kind of, I feel like there's a lot of pretense in the way people try to distance themselves from their own genre. And I can't stand that. Like, I can't stand rock bands saying like, we're not a rock band, or people that play music saying, I'm not a pop artist. It's like, just accept that you are, and that's a good thing, but you can be other things too. You can say, I'm not just a pop artist, I'm also an indie artist and a dance artist, or I'm not just a rock artist, I'm also an electronic artist. You can say that, but being like, I'm not this type of thing that, unfortunately, like, objectively, you are. Like, genres are, like, they exist whether you like them or not. They really do. And I mean, the metal is such a funny world, right? Because I think metal, genuinely, I think we have the biggest subgenre problem of any of any form of the music industry, because we, as soon as something sounds not quite like another band, we say it's a different genre. Like, it's insane, dude. Like, it's just now we're getting to subgenres of metalcore, and like, can't we just that's where I don't like labels, because I don't think that everything that sounds slightly different to another thing needs to be classified differently.
Yeah,
it's like, you don't need to classify the Beatles and the Rolling Stones in different genres, because the Beatles wrote some really weird stuff sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, they were still a rock band or a pop band. They're all of them. You know what I mean? Like, that's probably a really silly example to just go straight to Beatles and Stones. I sound like such a dick, but it's like, yeah, you know, I know I talk about real music. I've listened to the Beatles and the Stones. Yeah. Wow. No, it's just, I guess it's just one of those things where I don't, if someone says to me, like, are you guys a metalcore band? I'd be like, hell yeah. Are you a post-hardcore band? Hell yeah. Like, are you a metal band? Yes, I am but if someone said to me, to ask me to describe my band, I'm not good. I would kind of all use all those words, and I use them happily, because I don't see any shame in genres unless you think the genre that they're talking about is really shit. And then ironically, if you think that genre is really shit, then it's your fault for sounding like it while you think it sucks. Why would you want to sound like it?
Yeah.
Don't tell me that you think the genre of music that you inherently sound like is a shitty genre. I can't stand when you see metalcore bands being like, we don't even like metalcore music. We don't even listen. Like, I mean, I understand that. No, I don't listen to metalcore music every day. I can't. I live that shit. I play the music all the time. All my friends are in metalcore bands. I have to listen to other music or I go crazy. But I would never be like, oh, I don't even listen to metalcore anymore. Like, well, I'm all for being honest, but I don't like people trying to act like they're above the music that they create, you know? And that's because I think it's a weird self-hating thing. It's like, stop trying to put down this type of music I think it's a sense of thinking that there are things about the music that they think are uncool, and they think some of the artists that play the same music as them are uncool, but they don't really know how to write anything else, and they actually secretly kind of love it, but they're too worried about what everyone else thinks, and they're too worried about what is trendy. And you get these guys like they just try to separate themselves from their genre, and I'm all for saying I don't want to be restricted by genre. I'm all for saying that, but I just don't like genre denial.
Yeah.
I think it just creates like a silly, like the type of dialogue it creates with your fans. And I think it's almost like it's dishonest. I think it's disingenuous. And I think just embrace all of those things, unless you can point out to someone why you don't fit into the characteristics of said genre. Like, if someone labeled me as a genre and I was like, I don't even get what you're talking about. Like, that genre, if someone said you're in a grind band, I'd be like, grind has specific characteristics that we definitely don't have. And we have specific characteristics that it does not. The Venn diagram is very small crossover here. So no, but like, yeah, my approach to genre with our band, and I think this has allowed us like a great degree of liberty, is to just look at ourselves as like, the three words I use when I think of my band is heavy, melodic, emotive. That's all I care. There are three things I value in my music. Now, I'm not saying, like, I'm not calling that my genre. I don't want anyone to think that I'm telling them I've invented a new genre. I hate that. What I'm saying is that it's like, those are just the factors that I guess to me define. And when I hear things that have those three factors in them, in whatever ratio, that's kind of what makes up our sound. And that, I think that allows a lot of leeway. And when I say heavy, that doesn't have to mean breakdowns. It can mean riffs. It can mean You can have parts that are entirely chordal with single kick that are heavy. You can have breakdowns. You can have blast beats. You can have slow and sludgy, like doom metal riffs if you want. Like, it just allows, you can have southern riffs. You can have punk rock. Like, I think just opening that and just, I just look at it as heavy music in this big umbrella term. And sure. I'm sure some people would disagree with my view on that, but I'm a big fan of the umbrella world of heavy music. And within that, I don't try to separate things. Absolutely. I just really like, I like a lot of bands that sound different to each other. And I like a lot of bands that sound similar to each other. So like I said, I think they're just kind of obsessed with, people are obsessed with labels in our scene. And that's why I think it's, I don't bother trying to like get away from them or saying, don't label my band. I just say like, yeah, I'll take it.
Absolutely. I mean, it is an interesting thing because obviously coming from the prog scene myself, there's a bit of crossover there with the whole, you know, metal and prog and da 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 da.
We cop flack from people sometimes because people will say that we're prog and other people will say, no, they're not prog. And I would say we're prog tinged. We're just like, but dude, we write songs with verse and choruses. We write pop songs sometimes. Yeah. Like, honest to God, we write basically pop songs with heavy guitars and I love doing that.
Yeah.
So I would never say we're a prog band because I'd be lying to people if I said that's what, but I would say, yeah, we have prog tinges. We have elements of it. We have progressive songs here and there, you know? But our mentality is maybe influenced by that of prog bands, and we love prog bands. But I wouldn't consider us one in that. I wouldn't. If someone said, "Will you headline this prog festival?" I'd say no.
Yeah,
because it's like I would feel like getting up there and apologizing for not. Here, we're gonna play. Yeah, we're gonna play. This song's called Masochist.
it's 3 minutes long.
Yeah, it's 4.5 minutes long. Thank you very much. But it's not a prog song, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some prog guitar tones.
I think it's really interesting because you do get that judgmental thing going on in the prog scene massively, right?
That's because prog is for nerds, and I say that as a nerd myself.
Yes, absolutely, it is.
And a lot of prog, and I say this as a pretentious prog fan myself. A lot of prog fans are pretentious.
Yes,
and I'm owning that, like, because I'm a prog fan too. And I'm sure I get pretentious. Yeah, look, we've all been accused of that. The culture is, unfortunately, the culture sometimes can be a little pretentious. And it makes me sad because it's exclusionary and I think it scares people off.
Yeah, well, I think this is the thing, right? And we were talking about this on the podcast the other day, Hoggy and myself. But you get a lot of people, particularly when you're at festivals or if you're at gigs and so on and so forth. The prog scene is probably one of the worst for this. And I was wanted to find out whether or not you'd experienced this at any of your shows. Those people, you've got two albums out now, by the way, and both fantastic albums, particularly the new one. It's absolutely fantastic.
You like better than the first one?
Yeah, I think I do. It's a little bit more.
I'm always curious about that.
A little bit more up my alley.
We've been split on people with that. Like some people are like, oh, the first album is the one for me, or like the second one is growing on me, but the first one is special because it was, you know, the first thing they found of us, maybe, which is really cool. But some people just genuinely think the songs are better, and that's dope too because I love those songs. But
I got to say, I really love the film clips.
It's really split too. I love that. Oh, like, thank you. The film clips,
particularly, is it Hyperventilating? No, not Hypermania. Hypermania. Sorry, that was Voyager. Hyperventilating. Yeah, Hypermania. The new clips. So good.
Thank you.
It's so good. I mean, gorilla filming and all that.
My favorite, the train station ones are my favorite moments.
You did that in Oatley, right?
No.
Or was that at Helensburgh? Okay, cool. Yeah.
Shy Band through and through. We've done two or three videos in the Helensburgh tunnel now. I think two, maybe. We might go back for a third.
If you can get in there now, because it's all gated off.
It's not.
Really? Oh, really?
Is it? I don't know. Yeah. We were there 6 months ago.
Maybe it's gated off further in because I know they gated it off because people were doing stupid shit like.
Well, a lot of the glowworms have died, man. They're trying to let. Last time I went down there, I didn't want to go inside. So they said let the glowworms come back. So we left it alone.
Yeah, well, it's people were doing stupid shit like lighting up.
Flares?
Not flares, but essentially the same thing. Yeah, you tie a piece of string or wire to some fine steel wool and light that on fire. What? And then you swing it and
light steel wool on fire?
Yeah.
Man, you shouldn't have told me that. I'm not a kid anymore.
In related news. Yeah. So you get that kind of judgmental aspect, and I always feel it's really sad because you're right, it does feel really exclusionary.
I hate gatekeeping, man. Like really,
it shits me, right?
I hope nothing that I've said about like, oh, people should and shouldn't say this about genre sounds like gatekeeping. Because what I'm really trying to do is do the opposite of that, but I'm sure it could be interpreted that way. But I really don't like anything that keeps people out of the culture. Mm-hmm. Unless the thing that's keeping people out of the culture that you're talking about is for good reason. Like, you know, if that person is exhibiting really awful and dangerous views, then I'd be like, you know, it's just, at the end of the day, for example, like that, you know, if you've come up and write like bloody white nationalist songs, then the metalcore community is not going to accept you.
Yeah.
That's a gatekeeping I'm all for, but that's a different kind of gatekeeping. That's just keeping everybody safe.
Yeah.
But I'm not for the gatekeeping of like, oh, if you don't know enough about this genre, then you shouldn't come to the shows. I'm not for the gatekeeping. I'm not even really for the gatekeeping of don't wear a t-shirt if you don't know the band.
Mm.
I mean, at the end of the day, as long as the band got that money, I don't like it if it was a bootleg, that's kind of upsetting, and you don't like the band or know their music, then that's just upsetting. But I hate that whole, you know, watching people try to rip into celebrities for wearing metal t-shirts. Some of them I understand, but some of them it's genuine. Like, some of these people love this shit. Like,
yeah. Some of it's hilarious though, I've got to admit.
Some people try to rip on Rihanna for wearing a Slipknot shirt. Rihanna likes Slipknot. I've seen her talk about it. Yeah. Like, she's cool as hell.
Yeah.
That's why we love Rihanna.
I can't remember exactly. Was it Margot Robbie, I think?
Yeah, yeah, Margot Robbie loves like Bullet for My Valentine,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, she went to a Slipknot show.
Yeah, and she likes Slipknot.
Yeah, well, she went to this Slipknot. I remember watching this thing. She went to this Slipknot show, and it was really weird because at the time she was on Neighbours, I think it was, and people were coming up to her going, oh my God, what's happening with like Keith's baby and shit? Like these 6'4" bearded, big burly dudes just going up and being like, what's happening in the next episode and shit. And she's just sitting there watching Slipknot going off their nut.
Oh man.
Which is just a hilarious image to me.
Wait, and this was in the show, you're saying?
Yeah. So like she was in the pit.
Oh my
and
God.
And people were coming up to her being like, yo, what's
sorry,
going on?
I understand. Yeah, people were coming up to her at the show. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, at the show. Yeah,
that would
be
so unexpected. Tiny little blonde woman. Yeah.
It really would be.
No, but I love that. I think that's one of the funny things about, like, I guess, heavy music, right? Is that people are really shocked, or like, not all of us are. Like, those who listen to the music aren't shocked, but those who don't listen to the music are very shocked when normal ass looking people, I express that they like metal music. And admittedly, sometimes I'm surprised. I'll meet someone's, you know, I meet a friend's, like a friend's boyfriend or something who dresses very, very conservatively, or like very, you know, private school, or, and I mean, I went to a private school. So, but just, you meet some of these people and they surprise you, or like, you know, the type of jobs that they work, I guess, sometimes guys who work in finance and stuff. And I guess most of the guys I know who are heavy music enthusiasts, even though I should know better than this by now, most of them, cause I work in the field, most of them work in music.
Mm.
So I know that what music they like, cause they work in music. But then you meet these, well, it's funny. Even I am guilty of probably forgetting that, like, I'll meet some guys who, you know, works a real upstanding suit job, and earns great money. And then, but on the weekends loves to go to his festivals and stuff, and, or really loves to go see, you know, his favorite band's Parkway.
Yeah.
Or his favorite band's Slipknot, or his favorite band's, maybe it's Five Finger Death Punch, you know? It's they like, it's just wonderful though. And I think the funny thing about metal is like, and what continues to amaze me about it is like the societal attitudes towards it. That people, there's still so much pearl clutching and still so much like, you listen to that kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I still get that. I still get that when I meet people. It's expected that metal listeners, or, and same with prog, like, I mean, like you can often pick if someone is going to be a fan of the type of music that you like, by the way they dress and talk and act sometimes. But like, a lot of people forget that like this type of music is listened to by like all types of people of all walks of life. I think the best example is like the Tool concert that happened the other week.
Yeah.
Do you know how many people told me they went to Tool that I was like, you went to Tool? Sick. Tell me about it. Was it awesome? Like, and I love that. Like,
spoiler, it was.
Yeah, of course it was. Yeah. People really surprise you. And I think the weird thing is, because metal doesn't get that mainstream exposition all the time, people, it just does live underground.
Mm.
And it doesn't have to, because it's so widespread. You know, these bands are selling out stadiums.
Yeah.
And we still act like it's this thing for like
rebellious
teens.
This
left of field, this really oddball thing for the real niche crowd. And the fact is, it's like Soundwave was the biggest festival in Australia for several years.
Yeah.
Like, it says a lot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it?
It is. It's interesting. And I think what's really interesting about the metal community is the live aspect of it. So when you go to live shows,
so live focused.
It really is. And you get so much more out of it, particularly in the metalcore and, you know, stuff like Polaris and so on and so forth. Like for myself,
I hope they get something out of it.
I mean, honestly, seeing when I saw you guys at, it wasn't the Enmore show, it was the one prior to that at Metro. That was one of the best live shows I've seen in Sydney.
Thank you.
It was so well done.
The Metro, you said?
Yeah.
Man, that show meant a lot too. That was a really important show for us.
It was huge, right?
Yeah.
My question is, with the whole coronavirus thing and everything that's going on, what's going to happen? So, you know, we just before we came on air, you were talking about your girlfriend who...
shout out to Tessie.
Hey, Tess.
two streets away.
Just open the window.
Yeah.
She's working on some stuff for her job at the moment, and they were talking about doing it over Zoom.
Zoom, yeah.
Which would just destroy the entire thing with it. But that being said...
Well, they did a lot of lessons over Zoom at first, but obviously, like, it was other things. You know, what we were talking about as well was, like, you know, you got schools have got funny considerations they have to make about things. You know, like, if your school was putting on a school play, now are you gonna, you might have all the kids back at school. That might be... you know, allowed in the restrictions, but are we allowed to cram 500 parents into the school hall to watch a musical or a play? I don't know. You know, these questions are coming up a lot for them. So it's like, they're facing some, funnily enough, some of not so different questions to what I am like in my stuff, but yeah.
So what's going to happen with it? Is it all going to go online? And my concern with that is when you see bands like, some bands can get away with it, right? So if you Dream Theater, for example, Tool will never do it, but, you know, Dream Theater, you know, more proggy kind of stuff, you can kind of get away with it because it's more about watching the music.
You're talking about playing with no crowd. You're talking about live stream shows.
I'm talking live streaming shows, playing with no crowd.
This is a really interesting topic, hey?
Yeah, it is an interesting topic.
Okay. Well,
and from both sides. So
let's just say, okay, what are we trying to look at? Like, are you asking why? What do I think is going to happen? Is it going to move to? Is that going to become a big movement? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. I don't think so, because I think we only have, like, in Australia, I think we have another 6 months maybe before small scale shows come back, and I think by the end of year, big festivals will be back. I guess I'm saying, like, people will do it. What I hope they do is I hope they find ways to monetize it, because what really upsets me at the moment, and I'm sure some people are going to label me as a, oh no, he only does this for the money. Fact is, I've never done it for the money, but when you do this full time, you need money sometimes.
Yes.
So
eating is nice.
Yeah. It's like, if people, for the amount of work that, like, that has to go into it to play as many shows as, like, bands at a similar level, or even some bands like at a, you know, who aren't doing the stuff that we're doing, or are doing more, like, bigger stuff than we're doing. Mm-hmm. The amount of work that's required to sustain that is quite a lot. And I don't think people realize that artists actually going on and performing for free online, well, it's a really lovely gesture to cheer you up and show solidarity with you. It doesn't really show any solidarity back to them by watching them if you're not paying them for the time. You know what I mean? Like, it's nice to show up and show supports and comment and tell that artist that they're the best. But normally when you get to see that artist, they get something in return and they deserve it. They're working.
Well,
they are not just having a good time. I'll bet you they are. They damn well are. But they also, people deserve to be paid when they're doing something they love, if it's something that is providing a service for other people. And I've seen, it's been really interesting seeing some artists stand up and say, hey, can I say to all my artist friends, if you really want to go out there and do, you know, a short live stream or something, you know, that's up to you. But I kind of implore you to maybe reconsider, because every artist that does a free hour stream puts pressure from the fans on every artist. Sorry, adds to pressure from the fans on every artist to do the same thing.
Yeah,
because he did it and he's massive. Why won't you do it? Are you better than him? Like, he'll give to his fans. Why won't you? Well, he actually earned more money on his last tour than I did, though, so he can afford that.
Yeah.
And it's stuff like that. Like, they just don't get that. And I'm not even, like, saying that's the reason, but until we can monetize live streaming more effectively, you know, you could do it through Twitch. Mm-hmm. You could do it through Patreon. There's a lot of ways to do it, but a lot of people are scared to do it, because every time someone asks to be paid for that kind of thing, fans jump down their throats, and it's kind of disgusting because they don't really appreciate that asking an artist to do literally anything is worth paying for. It's really sad. Like, I think some people, I honestly think some people out there who consume music, you know, so many of them really care and they appreciate the value of the merch they buy and they appreciate the value of the record. Most of them do, but there are a small number of them out there. I don't think they even realize that bands are supposed to make a profit off the merch. I think they see that wearing a merch as a favor to the band because they're advertising you. I've literally had people basically say that to me. They're like, oh, it's a bit expensive. And you're like, well, yeah, it's, you know, like, it's a $20 shirt. And they're like, well, how much does it cost to make? like friends and stuff. Not good friends. Not people I'm friends.
Obviously
friends.
Not. Yeah. No.
Some people are just, and they ask these questions naively. You know, they're like, oh, but why, you know, but how much does it cost to make? Oh, $10, $10.50. So you guys make $9.50 per shirt. Yeah, yeah. And they're like, oh, yeah, it's, you know, it's actually one of our major sources of income. Oh, but you're not a t-shirt company. You're a band. I mean, it's a lot to charge people a lot of money for them to wear your logo around, don't you think? And I was like, what?
I'm sorry. You come back to me when you're not wearing the Adidas t-shirt.
It's like, did you know that you can go to any store and buy a t-shirt with no logo on it for $30 and it cost $4 to make? Did you know that?
Yeah.
They'll charge
made
you.
Made by some sweatshop in Bangladesh or
people
something.
Generally, there's a big, I think, I don't mean to generalize this because really not the majority, you know, I know so many wonderful like music consumers and fans who are like, so really understand the value that they bring to the industry and are really treat artists really wonderfully and really want to show what they can do and support. And I think that's so, I think honestly, the value of the fan has become very apparent in the past few years. I think I was saying to someone on an interview recently, actually, that I think what's cool about COVID is in a weird way. What's cool about, did I just say that? Jesus Christ. Let's take that off the record. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Leave it in. But that's a terrible, Jesus. What's cool? It's like a slogan.
It's going on a shirt.
Let's say one of the strange silver linings to this awful scenario is that I think it's put power in many ways. It's taken a lot of power out of the hands of the artist in some ways, but it's put a lot of power into the hands of the fan, which can be dangerous because some fans don't know about that power. But when they realize it, they want to help. There are people, fans are messaging their favorite bands and saying, what's the best way to support you during this time? If I buy it off iTunes versus Bandcamp versus something else, which one gives you the more money? They're asking those questions as consumers. And I don't think people used to do that. Maybe the real diehards did, but like, I think that's growing. And like, although plenty of people are still naive and they'll still go, I hope your record charts well. I listened to it twice on Spotify and you're like, oh, Margaret, that's not how it works. but that's, you know, it's people are, at the same time they care. And, you know, and I think even just realizing that streaming, although it's not great, it's also not Napster, you know, it's putting something into the artist's pocket, however minuscule.
Yeah.
And I think people are understanding the cool thing is this might be wishful thinking, but I think all of that is in a strangely roundabout way, despite the fact that obviously it's detrimental to artists in the grander scheme, in a roundabout way, it is people realizing what power is in their hands to support the arts that they love.
Yeah.
They're supporting them more directly because it's not like you bought a record and then, I mean, in some ways it's indirect because I know that it takes a long time for the money to trickle down, but there's what the level to which they consume the music these days directly influences how much the artist benefits.
Yeah.
That's both positive and negative, right? If you're a really niche artist, but your music is really renowned in your area, but you're only listened to by a few thousand people, it's probably a bummer that unfortunately that means you're not going to do well out of that democratic listening style. You know what I mean? Because, you know, if you're an expert at some really niche instrument or something like that, and you appeal to that, like you deserve to be paid as an expert, but you won't make that on your record sales because not enough people are buying them.
Yeah.
And you can't charge more for them on streaming. So it is a bit of a cruel world if you exist in a niche style of music, but it is, in a weird way, there's a little upside to it because people, you know, it has always really been the power has been in the hands of the fans, but it's just more directly there now. The results are more tangible in a strange way. I don't know. Could be totally wrong, but.
Oh no, I just find it an interesting concept. Because I mean, personally, I think that streaming will allow, I think what's going to be actually quite good is a hybrid. So having digital tickets available for shows as well as main tickets.
I would love that. So, dude, do you know how much I would be happy to pay, say, $20 to tune into a stream of one of my favorite bands playing? Like, okay, I don't know. Have you seen the Gojira live footage?
Yep.
Do you know how much I would pay to watch that in HD?
Yep.
Like that 1 hour one that's on YouTube, I'd pay for that any day. It's incredible. Yep. You know, if it's a band of a really great caliber or, you know, to be there, you know how much I would pay to be there to watch like, to be a fly on the wall for like when Knock Loose did their record launch show.
Yeah.
I would pay to have a camera view of that 100%.
Yeah.
Like that, I feel like that's, you make a good point there. And I was thinking about that in the early stages of COVID, but I haven't really thought about it since. And it's, I mean, That comes down to that big question, right? That question's been going on for ages. Is the internet and YouTube and the availability of, if I didn't go to the concert last night, I can go and watch it on the internet tomorrow.
Yeah.
Is that going to replace live music? And I say, hell no. I have a very firm stance that that will never, ever work, because to me, maybe I'm different because music is a very, very big part of my life.
Sure.
But I think a lot of people are in the same boat as me in that way. But to me, the live experience can't be replaced.
Yes.
Especially not for, and that's like you said before, that's specifically somewhat genre dependent.
Yeah.
Some genres translate really well through that way. Mm. But every genre is best felt in person. Mm. Every genre.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's certain notes that you can't replicate without a system like that, right?
It's a system as well. It's the system. That's the thing I was thinking about. Blame the system. It's the system. It's in the system, as King Parrot would say. What I was thinking about, even though when I was younger, I used to be really cynical about EDM performers. That's me confessing. I apologize. I used to be so cynical about EDM and DJs and the idea of getting up on a stage and pressing play.
Mm.
You know, laptop, USB goes in, press play, dance and look pretty and say, ayo, and put your fist in the air. It looks like a great time. But when I was younger, I used to be like, ugh. I will say that I do think that there is a very big financial disparity between that world and what our world, which usually comprises.
100%.
And I don't hold this against those musicians. I hold it against the industry. I hold it against the industry that this is the way things are. But that a person who does get up there and put on, you know, something that might be somewhat or largely pre-recorded as one man with a table and a laptop can get paid more than five people who bring a truckload of gear and are playing every note that you hear live.
Yeah.
It's quite a cruel world but there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah.
It's what the common man is consuming. It's what people are buying. You know what I mean?
It's the market, right?
God, that sounded so pretentious. It's the common.
No, but you're right.
Like Bane. The common man. Yeah. No. So what I'm saying is that I used to be more cynical about that, but I guess I'm just saying that over time, I've realized that it just is what it is.
Yeah.
Wait, how do we get onto this topic again? The DJ's topic. We're just talking about
the live experience.
Oh, sorry. What I was going to say about that. Yeah. And this is what I came to realize after years is I was like, why would you even pay so much money to go see that? He's not doing anything. And then I realized when I would go see electronic music live and I started going to festivals and stuff, I realized it literally doesn't matter if the guy up there is or isn't pressing play. It's sick if he's doing it live. It's sick. But you go watch Hermitude or something, that stuff will blow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Am I thinking of Hermitude or is it Fundamentals? I might be mixing them up. But yeah, this stuff being done live on Ableton pads and stuff like that will rock your world. But even if it's not being done live, some stuff just sounds, you need to be in the place. You need to be surrounded by people. You need to be disgustingly sweaty. You need to have some dude next to you yammering in your ear as his jaw is falling off. It's all part of the experience. Someone's begging you for a cigarette, even though you don't have any.
Someone's offering you illicit substances.
It's just the whole thing, or the chaos and the, as much as all that stuff does get, as you get older, you can start to feel like I'm too old for this shit. You start to get a little bit Danny Glover. I love it. And I don't think I'll ever hate it. No matter how old I get. We talked about that after Splendor, because I met a lady at Splendor who'd been going to Splendor for as long as Splendor has been a Splendor.
Mm-hmm.
She said she'd been 16 Splendors or something.
Wow. Okay.
I think there's only been, they're almost at the 20th anniversary. So she's been to almost everyone. And she was in her mid 30s. And I was like, you know what? If I lived in Byron Bay, hell yeah, I'd keep going. I think you don't have to always experience this stuff the same way. You can party differently. You can get better sleep. You can go to a hotel instead of a tent.
Mm.
But I actually kind of hope that in the years that come, I'm still enjoying that stuff because I just don't think there's anything that does quite compare to it. Even all the negatives that come, even the sunburn and the and the heat stroke and the dehydration and the sweat and the everything that comes with a silly day at the festivals, it's such an experience and it's something very very unique, and I hope I'm not misusing the word, but in a weird way, there's almost a very tribalistic behavior that I think is really wonderful about it.
Mm.
And I don't think that will get replaced. And in the same way that, that's festivals, but I don't think, I guess what I was trying to say is that there is a power to even the music that is maybe pre-recorded, some of it, even to that music, there is a power to seeing it live.
Yeah.
Because the atmosphere and the people around you enjoying it and the noise and the chaos and the system shaking you can't be replicated at home.
Yeah.
You can try and get close, but you never will.
Yeah.
And it's the same. And that rule is the same from that to like going to see a band of Frankie's Pizza. You know what I mean? It's still the same. Like,
Four venues that are left in Sydney, but you know.
I think if I didn't believe that, I don't think I'd even be doing this. Like, because, you know, it's very hard to imagine myself making a career playing music not in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd be, I love music and I would still try and find a way to do it. But I don't know if the addiction would be as strong without the adrenaline of the live show. Like, just let's imagine a horrible dystopian world for a second where we don't ever go back to shows for the next 100 years.
Mm.
And the whole thing is like hella H.G. Wells. And there's just, imagine like that world, right? Like, people would still be musicians, but I don't know how many of us would keep going, at least not in my scene. And I'm not saying that because we don't have the drive and we don't have the talent. I'm sure we'd all find ways to direct our music into hobbies and we'd find other ways to monetize it too. Those of us that depend on it for income. I mean, hell, I've been doing all my drum lessons over Zoom and it's great.
Mm.
I can't wait to have people come back and do drum lessons with me in person, but could I continue doing this feasibly for a long time? Actually, yes.
Mm.
I really like it, but it's not perfect, but I really like it. But live music's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
I think anyone who thinks that like you're going on YouTube and watching a shaky handheld camera or even watching a live DVD. I don't think I've ever watched a live DVD of Slipknot and gone, now I don't need to go to the Slipknot concert. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
And that's a fully HD, like edited, mixed professionally. It's not some shitty iPhone video.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've never ever watched something and gone, the only time I've ever maybe thought that is if it was a band I probably wouldn't see anyway.
Yeah.
You know, if I go, I'm not going to pay for this. So I watch it on YouTube and I watch it on YouTube and I go, they were all right. Maybe one day I will pay for it.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll go, that was enough. I don't need that now. You know, in that case, I wouldn't have spent the money anyway, but it's not going to, I'm not going to go like, you know what, let's pass on the $150, even if it's an expensive ticket, let's pass on paying $200 to go to see Slipknot.
Yeah.
Because I'd rather sit at home and get 80% of the experience on a screen. I wouldn't.
Mm.
I'll do that anyway. I'll probably do it the night before to psych myself up. Like, it's not, so no, I mean, to answer your question, I'm actually, maybe I'm overconfident, but my view is that live music is something that, like, I know that it's a young, what we currently know is the live music industry and scene is actually a really young tradition. It's like a 50-year tradition, so a 70-year tradition, which is crazy. Like, I had this conversation with someone the other day who was like, do you realize that touring hasn't always been a thing? And it blew my fucking mind. Yeah. Like, I was like, I think about it and I was like, oh yeah, this is the way it's always been. Bands on the road. It's like, it's not, man. Like, dude, like, because the way he brought it up is he said, do you realize that is, I think one of someone from, we're back to Beatles and Stones. Someone from like the Rolling Stones criticized the Beatles, apparently. Don't quote me on this. Apparently criticized the Beatles and said, you guys weren't a real rock and roll band because you weren't a road band. The Beatles came up before the Stones and they barely toured. You know, they came to Australia once and it basically caused like
pandemonium.
Riots. Like, it was insanity. Yeah. And then, you know, they didn't live in buses for weeks on end.
Yeah.
They didn't do that. They did a few runs. They did a lot of flights. They did a lot of hotels, but touring as an infrastructure didn't exist.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that about the Beatles. And when he said that, I went, oh my God, that's why I can't find all this footage of the Beatles.
Yeah.
Like, when I go and look for good, like, concerts of the Beatles in specific places that I'm curious about, there's not as much as I would have expected. And obviously they broke up before live concert DVDs, but it's like,
well, yes. And they stopped touring.
It's so weird. This wasn't a thing. It wasn't until like 60 years ago that someone went, what if we played a show? Then the next day
we played another.
We drove overnight. And we woke up and played another one. And then we did that for a month. Like, this, imagine someone suggesting that as like for the first time, is they basically took the traveling circus concept and applied it to rock and roll bands. I would love to know who were the first people to do that. I'm sure there was some intermediary between like, you know, the rock and roll boom and like, you know, between like Elvis and the Beatles and up to the Stones. Like, who were, you know, did the big bands of Yonder Is yonder the right word? Of yore? The big bands of yore? Did they tour in a bus?
I don't know.
Did the Glenn Miller band go out in a bus?
I've got a sneaking suspicion a lot of the blues guys
I've never
did.
Looked this up.
I'm almost certain the big blues guys...
I know they traveled.
Big blues they guys traveled, did. Yeah. I mean, they traveled, but whether or not they did a
Buddy Rich's
big,
band traveled and
tour
stuff,
thing is a good question. I don't know. We're going to have to look into that,
Sound like any... I'm sure there's some like... well-studied like music scholars or jazz scholars looking down on us just being like, this is terrible. You call this a progressive podcast. Yeah, no, it's like, and I probably sound so dumb, but something's just tweaked my curiosity right there. And now I want to go home and research the origins of touring because I guess it's my job. So
I think it's interesting. I've actually never thought about it myself.
Is there a doco? We should find, there's got to be a doco out there or
probably.
I'll make one.
Now you're onto it.
Yeah.
Look, I think it's really interesting, and it's interesting that you've brought up touring as well, because touring in Australia is vastly different to touring anywhere else in the world, partly due to the distances. We alluded to that a little bit earlier with the flights and so on and so forth. Driving from, for those of you who are listening in from other parts of the world, to go from one capital city to another, you're talking an hour and a half on a plane.
Yes.
Right, and that's just on the East Coast. God help you if you've got to go from Sydney to Perth, because that's like 5 hours.
Yeah.
It's a big place, and there's not really anything in between. Whereas when you go to, say, Europe, you're doing tour bus kind of stuff.
It's an entirely – overseas bands kind of love and hate touring Australia at the same time. And I kind of feel the same. Like, I will always love touring Australia. I always love the home shows. I'll always love having friends and family there.
Mm-hmm.
And I love this place. But, like – it's not the place, like the infrastructure doesn't exist. Unfortunately, geographically, it's not suitable. It's very hard. So we're really fortunate that Australia is a good market for us because it can be one of the things that can be really tough for a lot of bands is if some bands basically, you know, maybe their style of music or they get their style of music is more popular overseas or they sign with an overseas label.
Yep.
The thing to remember is that a label that doesn't exist in Australia or at least doesn't have like a big faction in Australia, has very little motivation to invest money in advertising you in Australia because the return is just not that big for them compared to the hundreds of millions of people in Europe and America, which are your two major music markets.
Yep.
Australia is essentially like, I wouldn't even say it's the third biggest music market. Like it is to us, but to pop music or something, Australia is probably much further down the line than say Asia or South America.
Yeah.
Which is South America is massive.
Well, the economics of touring just prevent a lot of bands from coming here.
Because I mean, we're an island. There's nowhere. Yeah. We're an island. There's no other countries where that we're joined to, and even within our country, there's like 7 cities. Like, it's crazy. And when they don't realize that until they come here, or they don't realize that you drive these huge distances. And I guess the difference is how quickly you can make money on a tour. What people don't realize is that if you tour America for a month, you might be at a loss until like halfway through the tour. And then by the time you're halfway through the tour, maybe you've covered all your costs. And the second half of the tour might be you making profit. On an Australian tour, it's perfectly possible that you might not hit break even until the last show if you're traveling a lot. Or you might never break even if you're a small band. Like our first couple of tours, we straight up never got close to breaking even. You know, we're getting paid $150 a show. We're spending $400 on petrol to go between states.
Mm.
So that's not really feasible. So like, and when you only do, if we did a lot of shows in a row like that and the distances were a bit shorter, over time, the amount of merchandise you sell per show, even if you're getting paid absolute pennies, it accumulates to the point that you might walk away from that tour with a couple of grand. But in Australia, where you're only playing 6 or 7 shows, it's very hard to do that.
Yeah.
So I guess I know of bands who tour America like 8 to 9 months out of the year and basically barely go anywhere else. They can make a living out there. Like, how do you think the country music's like the country music scene exists as it does? They only come to Australia once every few years.
Yeah.
I don't think they do that much in Europe. A lot of those people are out of there on the road all year round in America.
Mm.
You just can't do that here. So we're really fortunate that we managed to, what I was going to say before is if you don't have a big fan base in Australia, but you're Australian, you end up spending the majority of your year in other countries in order to make bank.
Mm.
And then if every time you go out on tour in your own country, you go out knowing that you're going to come out getting paid significantly less than you could.
Yeah.
It's nice to that we, I guess we, you know, we, we've been really lucky to have accelerated quite quickly in certain places overseas to the degree that we have, which we're really, really thankful for. But we spent a lot of time here building first. Mm. So by the time we first went overseas, we already had a pretty decent foundation at home. You know, yeah. we were doing like at least like 500 cap rooms at home. Mm-hmm. I think we had just kind of cleared that, just going, all right, cool, we can do like 500 to 600 in Melbourne or Sydney when we first went to Europe. So that meant that it wasn't like some big disparity. We'd already worked out how to make our band sustainable at home before we went overseas. And that was really fortunate because it actually meant that for the first 2 years of overseas touring, when we were losing money, I think our first American tour, we lost a bit of money. Mm-hmm. The first two European tours, maybe. Don't quote me on that 100%. But like it was... we were able to kind of offset costs in other countries by making a little bit of money at home. We were making just enough at home that, because at that stage, no one in the band was getting paid. We didn't pay ourselves anything.
Yeah.
So for such a long time. So at that stage, it was like, well, we're not worried about walking out of this with a fee. So as long as the money that we make in Australia covers the losses of going to America or Europe, we can make it work. And so we just wanted to go everywhere, you know? Kind of still what we want to do, but now we don't have time to work other jobs really. So we have to be a little bit more considerate about finances. Mm. So, yeah.
Mm, mm. And I mean, that also bleeds into things like backline hire and so on and so forth.
This is a really interesting conversation that came up recently about the COVID thing.
Yep.
Was that one of the stories that broke my heart. Like I was heartbroken. Like I felt simultaneously like so like, I felt bummed for myself because at first, don't get me wrong, like, and my band, because we lost basically 12 months of scheduled touring. Only one of those tours was announced, which is Europe, but we had basically like a year planned out. And within that year was like 8 tours, maybe set up, lined up, all looking really good. So it was pretty upsetting to lose. But what really sucked is that I was like, well, thank God we got to do our headline tour for our album. We got to launch the album in Australia like 2 weeks or 3 weeks later is when COVID really broke.
Yeah.
So for a lot of people, we were their last show.
Mm.
It was my last show. I didn't go to any shows after my tour.
Yep.
I sat on the couch for a couple of weeks and rested and was thanked the Lord that the album was out and everything was going okay. And then next minute I wasn't allowed to leave my house.
Mm.
So, it was like, yeah, like I'm just so grateful that we got to do what we did because I watched what happened to friends overseas and that was the heartbreaking thing. Like how we had friends, my friends were this band Alpha Wolf, an amazing band that I know you know. They had just started their first American tour and let me tell you, the nightmare of getting visas to America is crazy if you're a band.
It's awful.
We got them literally like the day before we flew out and but they didn't arrive to us because we were in a different state. So we had to fly into America with no visas and then get them mailed to us and try and get across the border from Canada without the actual physical visas, which is a really crazy story for another time. But like that's our nightmare. Everyone goes through this stuff. Alpha Wolf had a similar situation that I know where it was so difficult for them to get visas. They finally get to America by the skin of their teeth. Everything's good. They've been on tour for 5 days, COVID-19, tour's over, go home. And they've got a van. They've got like, they're renting our drum kit off us. Yeah. Like they've got a driver with them. Like, do you have high backline? Like, do you know how intense that is? And like the crazy, even worse was like, one that broke my heart was like Diardi's Murder. They were 2 days into an American tour and they were doing full scale production. Pretty sure they had flames. They had pyro pots. They had like LED screens on the stage. They had one of the sickest lighting rigs I've ever seen. Honestly, I've seen videos of it. It was looking like probably the best death metal show I've ever seen personally. I would have been psyched. And they were on a bus. Like, so people don't realize the overheads for that stuff are insane. To hire backline for a tour of that scale, like a death metal show in theaters with production is mental.
Yeah.
And that tour got canned after 2 days. And I sat there and I genuinely like, I wanted to cry. I was like, you poor buggers, like to come home after that, like,
cause that sucks, man. That's like, career ending stuff for some. Yeah,
luckily it wasn't. I'm really hopeful that this prophecy, I've seen a lot of people are saying this will end some artists' careers. And I'm just, the one thing that keeps me going is that I know no one really works in this industry for the money.
Yeah.
So I hope, although we might have to take up other jobs in the meantime.
Yeah.
I hope everyone comes back to what they're good at. On the sad side, I think it's worse. I'm really thankful that we had just gotten to the stage that we are somewhat just getting by off the band financially. I mean, now that we're not touring, I've had to start teaching a lot more. That's a reality of it. Mm-hmm. I had to redirect. Okay, well, the income that we were going to have is not coming in anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's drastically changed my perspective on this year. But luckily I've been able to teach from home and stuff like that. But
all those kids learning D-beats.
D-beats for days, man. I'm just fortunate that I can go back to my music career anytime. As soon as this is over, like, we'll be back in action.
Yeah.
I think the people that I feel the saddest for are the ones that did. And luckily, the only things where we've suffered any financial loss is flights we'd paid for that tours got cancelled. So, and we're trying to get those back. It's complex, but that's what goes. That's all the stuff that's going on behind the scenes for people in our sitch. But there are people in far worse situations.
Oh, absolutely.
Who have genuinely lost a lot. And I just hope that that those businesses can recover. And I hope that anyone that has to take on that's had to take on another side job or something gets back to it. I would hate to see, if people find something new that makes them happy, maybe is the right time. But
yeah.
I hope that's not the case. You know, I hope that people, I hope everyone's ready to come back to it, because the fans will be. Everyone's raring for it. I know people are obviously going to be a bit hesitant about getting back in a room with hundreds of other people up close, but it's, I feel most for the people who are, say, on the verge of being where I'm fortunate to be right now, where I guess I can say that music is my career. Because it wasn't about a year ago. Only really became my real career about a year ago. But I feel bad for those people who are maybe on the verge of that and were about to make a year off their music. That's the ones that I'm a real, real bum for. And I mean, we kind of fall into that category too. We're about to make a year off touring, but we have other income streams. We're trying. So if you were at the stage where maybe you were just about to cut down your hours at your day job to go play more gigs, it'd be a shitty time. And I feel for anyone in that situation. I hope for anyone in that situation that they're not losing hope in making money from this, because it will come back. I have absolutely no faith that there will always be a market.
Yeah.
And that it's not going to dwindle. People's consuming habits change, but ultimately they still want it. So that's what I'm counting on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the weirdest times we're in, isn't it?
It is. It's what's really been pissing me off is the amount of fuckers who are starting podcasts.
That's why I haven't started one. I mean, you're good. You did it a couple of years ago. You did it before the thing started. What's that joke? What do you call a group of white guys standing close together? A podcast. I fucking love that joke, but it's like, I just don't want to be that guy. And I'm going to become that guy in a few years. I've always said I wanted to do a podcast one day. So, but now the joke is too big and I'm just like, oh, I'm just another random dude who talks too much who thinks he should have a podcast. I just like chatting to people, man.
Exactly. And I think this is the beauty of this medium, is you get to sit down and have decent conversations with people.
It's kind of an excuse for a chat.
Exactly. 100%. It's an excuse for some Tim Tams, a cup of tea.
We'd probably get together and have a chat anyway, but now it's just like a good reason to schedule one in.
Exactly.
It's nice,
it's like a regular checkup. So look, we're very rapidly, I suppose, we're crawling towards the end of this little chat that we're having. I suppose the last question is a question that I tend to end most of my interviews with.
Cool.
And I used to have another question that I used to end my interviews with, and it was, tell us something we don't know, right? That was the question I always used to ask.
First, can I tell you something
that
you don't know?
Yeah, please.
Can I tell you something you don't know?
Please.
Okay, I learned this really recently. It blew my mind. I had another one that just came into my head, but now it's just disappeared again already. Did you know that birds, they piss and shit at the same time and out of the same orifice?
Oh my God. No, I didn't. And that's both fascinating and horrifying.
And awful. But when a bird shits on you, it's also pee. It's all one. It's all the same thing.
No, that's why it's so
runny.
Isn't
that nasty? Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that hell nasty?
That's just awful.
Yeah. But now you know.
Oh God.
You didn't. Now you do. So I'm sorry. That's where my head just went. I'm sorry about that. But it was a recent fact. I feel like I've learned a lot in the last couple of weeks. I've watched so many documentaries, and now that I'm on the spot, there's my pretentious, but I watch a lot of documentaries. That's what I do. I have though. I've been nerding out on Netflix documentaries and shit. And I've forgotten all of them.
Thank you for the tidbit.
Yeah.
Now
you know something about birds.
But you've been interviewed by numerous different people, obviously all around yes. places.
I've also interviewed.
And you've interviewed numerous people as well for as part of the old job, which we established right at the start of this.
We've come full circle. I love that.
We have. What is one question, though, that you've never been asked that you wish you had a bit?
Oh, man. What's some interview questions that I, you know, it's the funny thing is I even got that question a little while ago and I really struggled. You know what? I guess like, I don't know about questions I really wish people had asked. Sometimes there's some nice questions like, you know, the people are like, oh, you know, what kind of legacy would you want your band to leave behind?
Mm-hmm.
Like, or what is something you've picked up from other bands like that you have wanted to, I guess, give to your fans in turn? You know, what's something that music has done for you that you want your music to do for other people? That's always an interesting question. I don't know. I'm trying to, there's so much. Even just, it could be a music question. It could be anything. It could be a life question. What's the meaning of life?
42. We know that one.
Yeah. That's I should have known you'd come back with that one. Such a nerd. That's a good one though. It's a good one. I don't know. Let's jump away from this for a second by asking, what are some of your favorite questions that you like to ask or you like to hear asked in interviews? You've done a lot of interviews.
Sure. I riff a bit. So I like researching a lot and then drilling down on shit that people sort of say. So you heard at least a bit of the Harry Myrie interview.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I like finding stuff and stuff that people have said in interviews and going, now you said this and what did you mean by blah, blah, blah.
I was thinking about that the other day. It's always really tough. Like you always go like, did I say that?
Yeah.
And the funny thing is sometimes you've been misquoted in the first place and sometimes you're like, yo, I literally did not say that. Like,
yeah.
I would have worded that very differently.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, what's coming out of that for you? What have you found? You come across some really cool questions that way?
Well, there was one that I was actually going to ask, but I decided to sort of bin it because I wasn't sure whether or not we may have to cut around it. But when you were writing the new album, you actually said in an interview with, I think it was either with Triple J or ABC, same shit, but you know, who knows? And you mentioned that there were some, you basically had to sort of have a chat to the whole band. The whole band had to come together and have a chat and basically have a little heart to heart and some truths spoken about everyone and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were some of those truths? Like, were they things like, hey, dude, you know, I think you really need to, you know, wear some cologne every now and then. Or, you know,
that's probably me. That's why they say that to me. Yeah. Dan,
you're Dan, a drummer. It's yeah, I am
the
drummer.
I'm the hairiest guy in the band. I'm sorry.
Jesus, like, seriously?
Are you kidding me? I'm half Sicilian, dude. You'd see my face.
Yeah.
Rick does have the better beard, but his chest doesn't compare.
Right.
Does not compare. I'm sure he's very jealous. sorry, what was the question again? Oh, wait, the truth that came up. Man, like a lot of it, you know, some of it's just uncomfortable acknowledgement of personality flaws. And like when you have five best friends who have slept in vans, slept on mattresses next to each other on weird people's floors, slept like you've been in each other's space all the time. Like you've been best friends for 7 years. Like you've made all these records. You've had so many fights.
Mm.
Like we probably have an argument at least once a week. Like it's like, and sometimes you could have like a somewhat heated, well, during writing periods, we probably have a heated argument once a week,
mm-hmm.
if not more. Like that's not because we hate each other. We fucking love each other, but we're passionate about what we're talking about. And sometimes it's really hard to make someone see your point of view.
Mm.
But sometimes the idea of them not seeing your point of view in the context of trying to create the most wonderful thing that either of you have created in this time is terrifying.
Mm.
If he can't see why this is a good idea right now, then why are we even making this song? Sometimes things just feel so extreme like that. And that can be so irrational, but, and that's something that I have to deal with. I can be so intense with what I want in a song. Like I can be, when I have a vision, I know it can be difficult to reason with me. That's something I had to come to terms with and I had to get spoken to about.
Mm.
And or other things of being like, you know, there were points in the early part of the album where I was being too negative straight up. And I know that, I can acknowledge it, but I felt negative. Mm. I didn't like what I was hearing. I was hearing music and saying, I think we should change this. I think we should change this. I think we should change this. I would do these things differently. And it was all getting knocked back. And none of my suggestions were were favored by the rest of the party, which is fine. It's they don't have to. But I was upset about that and I was frustrated because I'm like, if none of these things that I think would improve the song can be done, then that puts me in a position where I don't feel great about the song. Mm. If not, and I don't feel like I'm being listened to or being having my opinions met. And, you know, at the end of the day, it was a song that someone else had predominantly written. So I had to suck it up and acknowledge that I didn't get the vision.
Sure.
But in order to get there, sometimes we have to have a lot of difficult chats. And I had to sit people, you know, in the other perspective, you know, yeah, there were things that I was doing that was maybe at times potentially detrimental to the writing process, or without realizing it, maybe detrimental to someone's morale.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was getting so worried about us losing motivation that I was causing us to lose motivation. You know what I mean? Sure. Sometimes you create these self-fulfilling prophecies. We get stressed, man. Like we care so much about this. Mm. Like this genuine, I know everyone says that, but this genuinely is like, making records is like life or death for us. It's like the record the idea of putting out something that we didn't think represented our idea of a good record is like, it's like blasphemy. It's like horrendous. Sure. And that sounds so douchey, but that's just where we come from. Like that's how we approach, that's how I approach art in all ways. It's never perfect, but you always have to try to get it as good as you can make it be.
Absolutely.
If I don't have the idea to make it better, I'm going to agonize over that. Why don't I have the idea? Why can't I make it better? Why am I not good enough to make it better?
Yeah.
And sometimes that can send you spiraling when you're in a really like difficult place creatively. Meanwhile, though, you know, there were times when I had to sit other people down and be like, look, you're not practicing what you preach in regards to putting the work in right now, or you're prioritizing the wrong things here. Mm. Or sometimes it's just personality flaws and personal gripes. Sometimes it's, dude, stop eating my food in the middle of the night. Dude, stop leaving dishes in the sink and I have to clean them up. You know, sometimes we're living in a house together for 2 months. Like we're like, sometimes occasionally sloppy, you know, 26-year-old guys, like we're not, you get these, it's like, and none of us have roommates.
Mm.
So like we're each other's roommates for a couple of months when we make a record and we love it. We love our, like, we actually kind of love our little family holiday in a cheesy little way, but it's difficult too. Yeah. You know, we adapt. You have to adapt from living with your family or your girlfriend to living with your boys, and you're living with your boys in a different circumstance to usual, where every day isn't, let's get up, let's ride bikes around the city, let's play a show, then let's get on the bus and have a beer.
Mm.
When that's not your everyday routine, it's a lot easier to get frustrated at each other.
Mm.
Sure, a tour can get frustrating, but it's a lot more fun and there's always something to look forward to. When you got 2 months or something in a studio and every day is like, if I don't make it better today, I have to make it better tomorrow. And I don't know how.
Mm.
Studio life is like, it's both the most exciting and wonderful thing and also like literally like the worst thing about being in a band, I swear to God. Like I love and hate being in the studio.
Mm.
It drives me mental. Like I become a difficult person in the studio, but I make sure it gets done too. I make sure that the record happens. And I think what happens in the studio is throughout the time that we're in there, we all take on different roles and not necessarily permanently. Mm. When you're around people a lot of the time, you do naturally fall into roles quickly and they might not always be the same or be permanent, but maybe for the first week or so, someone comes in and goes, all right, I've been thinking, this is how we should schedule our days to get maximum stuff done. We should do this from this time. We aim to be up by this time. And by this time in the evenings, we hang out, maybe play a little Nintendo and cook. And it sounds great. And, you know, maybe someone has that order and then over time, someone else suggests, you know, maybe we rearrange the day because I've been finding this isn't productive. And, you know, different people take on different roles and then someone gets burned out and one of us has to step up and become a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And that can cause problems too. If the person who was kind of leading the charge on the scheduling and the production and making sure that keeping everything in check, no one can keep that up for 2 months. We're not soldiers, man. Like none of us can do that. Like, so we have to go in waves. You know, there were waves when we got in there where there was one period where, and Jamie is somewhat less involved in the writing of the records and like the stuff we do at home before the studio than the rest of us, because we spend a lot more time writing the guitars and stuff. And he mainly comes in when we're demoing the vocals. And so I'll write and demo vocal parts and then get him to re-demo them. So, but there was a time in the studio where he recognized that we were all really struggling, like emotionally, mentally, motivation down the drain, not looking good. And he, to his credit, like I love that guy for it. Like he like really stood up and was like, I'm going to do my best and just not let them see that it's getting to me too.
Hmm.
I'm just going to take one for the team and I'm going to be strong for my boys.
Yep.
And it was incredible, man. Like, I've never seen anything like it in our band, honestly. Like, he really like just got out. He was up before everyone every morning. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I was usually awake first. I wake up at weird times, but I would wake up and he would already be downstairs, or he would be like the next person down, and he'd be showered, dressed, ready. He'd have got in his car, driven down the street, done some vocal warm-ups, like good to go on 9 a.m. like almost every day. Like, yeah. there was one period particularly where he was like that. And I was like, I could see what he was doing. I said to him, I was like, oh, thanks. Like, because we're really finding this hard at the moment. And sometimes you need someone. And I think it's good sometimes if you're not all creatively required to be putting the same thing in at all times, because none of us had the energy to do that. We were up till midnight, 2 a.m. writing riffs, making synth parts. And so he would go to bed, rest his voice, make sure he's taking care of himself and not getting sick, get up bright and early and get in there and make sure that if no one else is ready to work, he was. Yeah. And that's, you need that, man. And honestly, like the best, I'm grateful that although there's a lot of things, a lot of commonalities in the personalities between the band, there's a lot of differences too. We have a lot of different types, a lot of different approaches to things. We know how each other tick now, but it's good that everyone's a little different because it means that we can make up for each other's shortcomings a lot of the time and pick each other up on stuff. And I guess, yeah, coming back to that question of like, you know, we've been together long enough and we've seen each other. I think the other thing that affects it is being able to have those conversations is seeing each other go through some shit. Mm-hmm. Like, I won't go into it now because it's not something I can really talk about like on air, but I have watched my band members and my band members have watched me go through some like fucking personal hell, like over the last, especially the later years of the band, whether that was, you know, maybe dealing with like breakups or like loss of members of family, you know, deaths, and just mental health, depression, so much like within our, that we've had to be there for each other through. And all the things that come with that. Like when you've had to be there for someone like they're a family member, like as both like your like career, your like business partners, musicians, which I think doing art with someone is a certain type of bond of its own that's unique. Mm. You're like business partners, you're artists together, and you're basically family. When you've been through enough of that and you've had to be there and support someone through some bad times in their life or some parts that have brought out bad sides of them, it's a lot easier to sit them down and say, hey, like your behavior right now is causing a problem. It's a lot easier to sit down someone and I think we've been there for each other through so much shit that sitting someone down and being like, you need a talking to right now, or like you need to wake up, or you need an intervention about the way that you're acting, or I need you to talk to me and just confide in me because I can see things aren't okay. Whether it's any of those, it's a lot easier to do after all of this time. And I think we've just gotten to the point that the barriers are just so down. Like there's still small barriers, but they're just not, when I think about 5 years ago, like the barriers in our band are just so low, sometimes too low. Like, and so that's part of the problem. That's something that we talked about in the studio. Someone said to us, well, I think our producer said to us is like, part of the problem with you guys is like, you know, maybe someone snaps at someone one day and says something they regret, you know? And he said, part of the problem with you guys is that you're too comfortable sometimes to say exactly what you're thinking to someone or to say exactly how that guy's making you feel. You're almost too comfortable to say it, even though the truth is very harsh. And sometimes it needs to be said, but maybe sometimes it's hurtful or sometimes it doesn't go the way you think it will go. And I was like, that's a very good observation. And it's something that, it was one thing that made us stop and go, maybe just because I think he needs to hear it doesn't mean that he needs to hear it, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes someone needs time before they hear the harsh truth. Or maybe the way that you think the harsh truth needs to be phrased is not the way that it needs to be phrased. But yeah, and I mean, this all might sound very melodramatic talking about a metalcore band of, you know, just kind of dudes from Sydney who've, you know, middle class, most of them have had pretty nice life. It's not like I'm out here crying, woe is me, but we've been through some stuff together and we've, you know, what doing music as a career and touring and traveling does is it can exacerbate things that you didn't know were there. Like I barely know anyone that tours that hasn't had a mental health scare or a period of, you know, of mental health difficulty.
Sure.
Because it literally comes with the territory and they all experience it differently in different volumes, and some of them act on it, some of them don't, some of them seek help, some of them don't, some of them recognize it, some of them don't. But it really does. It's not a normal lifestyle, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, but it's not a normal lifestyle. And what comes with it, all of that stuff that comes with the territory, means that I think if you're working in this industry, you need to surround yourself with people that you can trust and you can open up to, and you can, confide in and be vulnerable with. And that's especially, that's no matter whether you work crew, whether you work studio, whether you work anything, like whether you're the lighting guy, the gaffer, the anything, like, or whether you're the lead singer of a band, or if you're the bus driver or the tour manager, like any of it, like it's all stressful and it's all difficult and it's all weird and abnormal. And you're all in this weird, like traveling circus scenario. And I like the term traveling circus to describe bands, because not only does it conjure up a lovely, colorful imagery, it's also, I think it highlights kind of like some of the craziness, although it probably takes away from the mundane aspect that is definitely there that we always talk about, or the sitting around and staring at your phone. But it's, yeah, you know, in this type of thing, you've got to surround yourself with people that you can talk to.
For sure.
And that's probably also a nice place for us to be kind of leaving it on as well, is the nice little mental health angle, get that in there. But it really, it's important to me, you know, like I've realized over the years that like being part of this industry, like I think the best thing that we can do is have conversations about how difficult and weird this life in this industry is, and the things that, you know, the unique or unusual things that we encounter, and the commonalities between the people that are all in this thing. And recognizing that and realizing that it's good to just sit down and chinwag about the thing and just say, like, what a strange and weird and wonderful kind of like, yeah, experience all of this is. Yeah, it's about the people you surround yourself with. I think you got to be able to be honest. And maybe that's because, to me, all great art involves being vulnerable. I think to me, I not everyone looks at art this way, and that's fine. But the kind of art I like, the kind of art I really like, a lot of it is painful art. It's art that's an expression of something quite dark. I'm drawn to art that's a little bit like that.
Yeah.
So, and I think what comes with that is, and don't get me wrong, I also really like Real Big Fish. You know what I mean? Like everybody's doing the fish. Yeah. But it's like, what I'm saying is that I guess in order to do that, you have to be supported by the people around you, and you have to be comfortable with the people around you.
Absolutely.
And that's what's, and I find that really, that's led in turn to me making some of like the most beautiful connections I've had through this kind of music. Cause I know that I couldn't sit on a bus with I'm happy to talk to anyone. I'm comfortable with most people having a conversation, but I know that I wouldn't be likely to be sitting in the back of a vehicle at 3 a.m. With just anybody talking about, like, I don't know, anything, like talking about the importance of the separation of church and state, or talking about like altruism, or like, I remember or talking about like personal mental health journeys, or talking about addiction, or talking about language, or talking about like feminism, I've had some of the most interesting conversations with about things ranging from all ends of like things like philosophy to mental health to like politics and even like academic shit that I would never expect, like stuff that pertaining to stuff that I talked about with friends, like teachers in high school as a nerdy kid, that I'm like, when you like are discovering people on tours and stuff are interested in as well. So many of us come from this same place and the same background. So many of us are kind of like, have had these weird interests and a little bit nerdy. And then in the same way, like so many of us have gone through so many similar things in terms of our life experiences and personal challenges and mental health and stuff like that. And I know that I couldn't just be sitting there at the back of the bus talking in depth about, you know, yeah, those kind of topics and addiction and depression or things like that with just about anybody. Like there's something really wonderful that I think binds, a lot of people that make art together in that way. And I'm not saying that other people don't have those conversations, but I'm just really thankful that in the community that I belong to, that stuff is welcomed and that it's encouraged. And that for the most part, at least in the scene, I can't speak for the whole heavy scene, but in the scene that I know, the people that I spend time with, and the bands that my band plays with, they're very different in that way. They like to the traditional image of what people expect from heavy music. They're down to talk about this stuff. They're down to get deep. They're down to expose themselves in personal ways. I didn't mean that, you know. That's they are not down to expose themselves.
You heard it here first.
God damn it.
The flashes.
Oh, Jesus. That's not what I... Oh, my God. Fucking...
It's not an issue. We get it.
I was in the middle of some real deep moment. I had to spoil it for myself there. But I'm saying that I think you feel me.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably a nice place to wrap it up. But
I think so.
I guess I would say to end the question that we started on there when that big kind of ramble I just went on though, I'm just grateful to especially not just to be in a scene of people that a lot of them are like that, but in a band with people where we've over time broken down these barriers and cultivated a culture where we can talk to each other about our own flaws and each other's flaws and talk to each other about going through heavy stuff or just see each other through all that shit. Because I know of other bands who have struggled with opening up to each other, and sometimes it could cost them their band in the end. So I just hope that we've put in enough work and we care enough about this and about each other to just keep doing this for as long as we can.
Mm. Awesome. Well, Dan, you've been extremely generous with your time.
No worries, man. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It has. But it's awesome. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Dude, it's been great. I'm glad we finally done it.
Hey, me too.
I'm sure we'll find another time to do a sequel.
Yeah, more than likely. Dan Fenari 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Dude, I like that reference. Got me shabadoo.
Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Man, thank you. Before you go, I have one gripe.
Sure.
I brought this up to you. Your podcast is called the 9-8 Podcast.
And I know where you're going with this, yes.
I turned it on the other day. I thought, before I do the podcast, I have to listen to a little bit. So I listened to a little bit of your special with Harry Myrie, the dude cast. And I put it on and the theme song started, and every podcast has to have a theme. And I know, did you make it yourself? Did you write it?
Yeah, it was all recorded here.
There's no excuse then. So everyone either makes it themselves, or they pay a musician to do it, or they get something copyright free off the internet that's just got a little guitar chord or something, or a little Joe Rogan theme or whatever it is. But I was turned it on and it started grooving, and I literally started counting in 9, waiting for the turnaround, thinking I'm going to be the only guy that bops to this the first time. And it's in fucking 4/4, David. What the fuck?
You are the only person who has picked that up.
How?
I don't know.
It's a musician's podcast.
I know.
Why did you call it that?
Well, so the name was actually taken from a Dream Theater song, which is in 9/8.
So, is the Dream Theater song called 9/8?
No, it's called Voices.
So it's not taken from the name of the song?
No. It's just from the fact that it's in 9/8.
You could have called it the 9/8 Voices podcast.
Ooh, that would have been good. We actually got about 3 weeks in and
voices,
then I made a
13 moment. Voices? Wasn't that story about that woman who was possessed by demons? Don't worry.
Possibly.
Forget about that.
That is something that now that you've mentioned it, I'm like, fuck.
And I'm sorry, because I actually said to you the other day, I said to you, before I come on the podcast, I'll make you a new theme. And it'll be in 9/8. And I actually really want to do it. We'll track it on my Roland, and we'll slap a little, bring it over here. We'll slap a little bass.
We'll get to it. We'll
put a little 9/8. Unfortunately, my arm is currently, it's not currently dislocated, but it's recovering from being dislocated, which is
totally,
I can't believe we didn't even get onto that, but that means that I can't record it. I could program it for you, but that would be somewhat inauthentic. I think we should track it, but I couldn't believe it. When you stuck to God, you're like, did that not even occur to you? When you were writing the theme?
You know what? It did. And then I came up with the riff and I just went, fuck it. This'll do. And then Hoggy Green lit it and he was just like, yeah, it's cool. No worries. I'm like, excellent. I don't need to worry about doing this thing in 9/8. Although he did say at the time, he was like, oh no, it would be cool if you could do it in 9/8. And I just, honestly, I just got lazy. I just went, nah.
It's not hard to groove in 9/8.
It's okay. It's all right. I just find it funny that the first guy to actually mention it or bring it up, and we've had the guys from Voyager on here. We've had the James LaBrie from Dream Theater.
James LaBrie on here?
Yeah,
I didn't even know that.
We've had some pretty big prog names on here.
That's sick.
And the first guy does it.
I think what we've learned from this, and I hope that this goes on record, is that I know more about prog than James LaBrie of Dream Theater. And yeah, there we go. But no, I think you should.
I think
you need a new theme. It's a good
changed theme,
but it's not.
It will be changed.
Yeah.
But on that bombshell, I think that's a great place to leave it. Dan.
Let's leave it there.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Dude, left-handed handshake. There you go.
Easy. Hey guys, thanks for listening in to that interview with Dan from Polaris, and thanks to Dan for joining us on the show. I did just want to jump in here really quickly and say that if any of the stuff we talked about in this podcast, we did touch on mental health and so on and so forth, if any of it has triggered something for yourself, or you know, if you're feeling that particular way, always remember there are stacks of great organizations in and around the world that you can turn to. You can generally look these up with a quick Google search from your particular country. Here in Australia, there's some great ones. There's Lifeline, Beyond Blue, the Black Dog Society, and a whole host of others that you can turn to if indeed you are feeling like things are a little bit on top of you. As Dan said, many people in the creative industries, many people who go on tour generally are afflicted with some kind of mental illness. So if there is anything that has triggered that for you in this particular episode, please seek help. Help is only a phone call away. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode. My name's Dave Ellis. I'll see you on the next one.
The 9-8 interview.